Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everybody. We are taking a break from the live show today in honor of Memorial Day, this strange bedfellows of a holiday of honoring our war dead and frolicking at the beach. But in either case, we are off, so we're going to bring you some of our favorite recent conversations to listen to today. We think you'll enjoy these. All of them are very New York-centric, though at least one guest is not from our town of New Amsterdam. In fact, he's the mayor of Old Amsterdam. Coming up later, also Pulitzer Prize-winning Brooklyn poet Vijay Seshadri. He just won the Pulitzer this year, and you'll hear a call-in where we ask listeners, who taught you to be a New Yorker? In at least one case, it was a police officer who taught a listener the art of jaywalking.
He said, what's the matter? You look lost. I said, well, where I come from, you get a ticket if you cross on the red light. He said, you're in New York City now. You better cross just when everybody else does.
More like that coming up, but first, my recent conversation with a New York icon.
Some say love, it is a river that drowns the tender reed. Some say love, it is a razor that leaves your soul to bleed.
In April, Bette Midler re-released her 30-plus-year-old book about her first world tour called A View from Abroad. I talked to her in April as she recalled her blue sky world before the AIDS epidemic. We looked back, we looked forward, and we looked across to the Palisades for a current piece of her activism. It's the Divine Miss M, Bette Midler. Such an honor. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much.
You set the scene in the new introduction to the book, saying by 1980, the 60s were finally over. The cloud of HIV/AIDS was about to descend on the blue sky world I was living in. Looking back, how would you describe that blue sky world of 1980?
Well, it was a frivolous time. You know, creative time. There were a lot of wonderful things happening in art, in culture, in pop culture, in the huge amount of nightlife. It was just kind of reckless, a lot of reckless behavior. There was nothing dark on the horizon. That's what it felt like at the time.
And you were an icon for gay men in the 1970s. What do you think it was about your act that drew that crowd?
Well, you know what? I've been thinking about this, and I think I have a clue. Well, first of all, the fact that what I did was so over the top.
Yeah.
It was it was extreme, but it was also everything. It had everything in it. It had music, it had chatter, it had jokes. You would laugh, you would cry. You know, it had a great deal of emotionalism. It was hyper emotional. So I think that's how I think that's what drew them to me, and also the fact that I was that my name got around because I was working at the Continental Baths at the time. But I also think that when I stepped out into the wide world and was playing in nightclubs and small arenas and theaters, I think the fact that that entire community came together, and I don't think they had ever seen all of themselves in a room together. I think that really sort of knocked them out. I think they didn't realize there were that many of them.
It was after Stonewall, but it was before the contemporary height of the movement, which in a way formed around a response to the AIDS epidemic.
Well, yes and no. There was a lot going on between the Stonewall riots and the AIDS crisis. There was a lot going on. It wasn't as riotous as the AIDS crisis finally became. But there was a huge amount going on. There
absolutely.
Were lots of parades, lots of meetings, I remember being invited to, I could have gone, you know, all day, every day to this committee or that.
Uh-huh.
I went occasionally. I didn't go all that much because I was on another path, but it was curious to watch. The reason I say this is because I was interviewed the other day by a woman in Texas who said I was a when I went to your concert in the 70s, this is like the early 70s, I was a married straight woman, and she said, and when I got to your concert, there were so many gay people, and I didn't know there were that many gay people in the world. I thought I was the only one. And I said, really? She said she came out 3 years later, and she blamed it on me.
You broke up that marriage.
I was like, oh, my gosh. I didn't know what to say.
You mentioned
I'm sorry. So the idea that there was a community that they didn't know existed was, I think, something that had never occurred to me. I just heard about it last week.
And you mentioned the continental baths. For young people today who didn't come of age around that, I think it's almost inconceivable today. What feelings or images remain with you about that?
Well, but not what anyone thought about it. It was actually pretty wholesome, to tell you the truth. I wasn't interested really in what was going on behind the closed doors. I was really interested in getting up on the stage and honing my craft, which is what I did. And I had very long hair at the time, and my clothes were very, very low cut, and I was, you know, I wasn't wearing a brassiere, and I was wearing a lot of makeup, and, you know, really, camping it up, and my sense of it was that it was a lot of fun. It was a very exciting for me because people really appreciated what I did. So for me, it was a completely different experience. I was at the center of it, and I don't think it will ever be duplicated.
Bette Midler with us on WNYC, talking about the re-release of her book from the early 80s about her first world tour called A View from Abroad. Bette, you recall in the book that your goal was to make the book funny, but a lot of bad things as well as good things happened on the tour. Fist fights, drugs, accidents, arrests, screaming matches, fires, all your words. How did that tour make your 35-year-old self grow up?
Well, I realized, you know, the expression herding cats was probably created on that tour. How did it make my 35-year-old self feel? Well, I really wanted to get out from under. That was the first, you know, save yourself was probably my first instinct. But it was also pretty fascinating because it was there was so much acting out, and there was really very little you could do about it. I tended to, you know, to retreat, and I don't think that was really the healthiest thing to do. I, you know, subsequent tours, you would learn to sort of have meetings and kind of get a lot of things out in the open. In those days, we didn't do that. You know, people went their separate ways and were not what they were.
Today, you'd fire people.
Yeah, you would fire. No, you don't fire. You discuss.
Uh-huh.
You know, you sort of discuss the whole group. You'll have like group therapy together, or you'll have a very strong road manager who's the enforcer. You'll have the enforcer.
And
in those days, you know, that kind of traveling for us was brand new. So we didn't really, you know, we were flying by the seat of our pants. It was it's a different world now.
One funny moment in the book is when you write, my choreographer had, since I last worked with her, turned in her tutus and gotten into punk. This time out, number after number emerged dripping with violence and hostility. Is that a true story?
That's totally true. Tony Basil, the crazy great Tony Basil, oh, Mickey, you're so fine, who is still one of my best friends.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, she had decided she was into punk. Her picture is in the photo. Her photo is in the book. And one of the great moments of my life with Tony was when we made a movie together. Right after that tour, we made Divine Madness together, and she didn't think the costumes were punk enough, and she took a scissors to them just right before we were going to go on. So when the girls came to put their clothes on, they had nothing left. They were wearing, you know, two snaps and a set of buttons. It was hilarious, and of course the actual costumer was beside himself with rage. I mean,
huh.
I have to tell you, Show business is a laugh a minute. It's also a tear a minute, you know. It can be heartbreaking and heartwarming and hilarious all at the same time.
But the punk scene with all that hostility and your gay bath scene dripping with all that love and lust were going on at the exact same time in Lower Manhattan, one more in the East Village, the other more in the West Village. Looking back, did something connect the two as 1970s expressions, or were they just both there?
I think it was all in the air. It was all in the air, and people just couldn't help but pick up on it. And don't forget, there was a lot going on in the drug world, and there was all the, there was disco, which had taken over from, you know, sort of earnest music, earnest rock and roll,
right,
and earnest, very, very masculine rock and roll. And I think there was a major backlash at the end. In the 80s, I think everyone says disco is dead, January 1st, 1980, and that was the end of that. And the AIDS crisis started just around the same time. So there was a lot of bad behavior in the 70s, you know, huge amounts of drug ingestion and all that stuff, and bad, you know, hopping in and out of beds. And I guess the chickens came home to roost in a way. And that, you know, in a way they came home to roost in the 80s. So I think it was in the ether. It was the end of that generation's set of rebellions. And I was a kind of a bystander and a chronicler in a way. You know, I was a reflection. I wasn't at the heart of it. I was just reflecting it.
Brian Lehrer on New York and New Jersey Public Radio with Bette Midler on the occasion of the re-release of her early 80s book, A View from Abroad, about her first world tour. Lisa on the Upper West Side, you're on WNYC with Bette Midler. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was calling because in the late 70s, early 80s, my husband, who's since died, was diagnosed with AIDS, and I became HIV positive and been doing super well now. But in the late 70s, there were meetings that we went to where my husband was welcomed with open arms. Everybody's great, super sympathetic. He, you know, was really sick, and it was, you know, he got a warm welcome. And because I was a woman, and there weren't that many women, there weren't that many of us out there, and we definitely weren't going to meetings, there wasn't a huge welcome, there wasn't a lot of support for us. And I often thought of Bette Midler because, Bette Midler, you have always been out there for everyone, not just gay men, but for HIV positive women in a kind of a cheerful, wonderful, great attitude way. And I always kind of thought to myself, well, if she can be out there and do it and be who she is, I can too. So you have served as an inspiration to me. And Lisa isn't my real name. I'm not using it because I have children who are grown, but I don't know. I just wanted to say how wonderful you are and how inspiring and how open and generous and non-judgmental. How wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you,
thank you so much. That's really kind. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lisa. We have a lot of calls like that we could take. Let's take at least one more. King in Glen Rock. You're on WNYC. Hello, King.
Hey, good morning. Thanks. I want to speak to in the time in the late 70s before technology, and Bette, as a gay man in Louisiana, Bette Midler did reflect something that was extraordinary, and it wasn't just the art and culture. There was also an element of an outsider making it in a way that wasn't mainstream. I mean, Bette was diminutive. Jewish woman, seemed to have all this stuff against her, and she was bigger than life. And I remember seeing photos of her and having inspiration about myself without even understanding why. And so I respect her courage and what must have been a struggle, as all performers have, but seems to me probably more so for people who don't fit some stereotype of either talent or what we want to perceive as beauty.
King, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, King.
Does that ring true with you about the struggle? And
I, to tell you the truth, I was so lucky. I was so lucky. I think that my will must have been, you know, gigantic, because I just kept putting one foot in front of the other and not taking no for an answer. But I, in a way, actually what he says is correct. You know, I was an outsider. I was different. I did look different. I sounded different. What I was doing was different. Although in the continuum, in the river of what, you know, performers, what performers do, I was really doing something that had been done, you know, for eons and eons before me. I was I was the fool. I was telling jokes. I was a tumbler. I was making fun. I was sending things up. I was, you know, and I was doing it all. I wasn't doing just one thing. You know, I wasn't just singing or just dancing or just telling jokes. I was doing all of it at the same time. So, yes, I was an outsider. And although he says there was a struggle, there was a struggle, and the struggle continues because you still say, well, didn't I get that part? And you realize, well, you just don't fit that. You don't fit that bill. You don't fit that role.
And he mentioned you being Jewish. You grew up as a Jew in Hawaii, didn't you?
Yes.
Where in Hawaii, and how small a minority?
Where in Hawaii? Yeah. Well, I grew up in a town called Aiea, a small town called Aiea, which is still there. And my parents moved to that town in the early 50s, like 51 or 52. And I went to second grade there. I started second grade there, and I didn't really go. It was an all Asian school. There were Hawaiian. Well, I shouldn't say all Asian. It was Polynesian, mostly Polynesians and Asians in the school. We were the only white family in the school for years. And then some white people came, and it was, oh, look, there's white people. But it was, you know, my sisters were bullied. My older sister was bullied terribly. My middle sister, she did pretty well. She assimilated. But I was like, I was an introvert. You know, I was a reader and a bookworm. I kind of stayed stayed to myself. I was very shy.
And Jewish identified?
And I went for, huh?
Jewish
what?
Identified?
No, absolutely not. No such thing. Not on the radar. Jew, they didn't even know from that. What they did know is that you were white, and if you were white, you were like, it was anathema. They didn't want you near them. They wouldn't speak to you. I went from the time I was in second grade until the time I was in ninth grade with no one ever saying good morning to me or saying hello.
For being white.
Yeah.
In America.
No, in Hawaii, it wasn't really America. It was, you know what, to tell you the truth, it was a territory at the time.
Right.
And what?
Oh, right. It wasn't even a state. You were born in
a state.
1945?
I was. It was a territory.
So you were like the very first baby boomer.
I was. Don't tell.
Was your father in World War II?
My father came to Hawaii in 1933. He was in the Army in 1933 in Waianae on the other side of the island. And he came back to New Jersey, married my mother, and brought her over there in 1937, and then they stayed through the war. So no, he wasn't in the war. He worked for the Navy that whole time, and worked for the Navy until he retired. So
the time you were 20, you were on Broadway in Fiddler on the Roof.
I think I was maybe 24, 23, 24, yeah.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. My guest is Bette Midler. We're talking about her career as an outsider, her early life in Hawaii, and some of her present activism. How did you develop your kinds of showbiz sensibilities in Polynesian Hawaii as a white minority of one?
I watched. I had my eyes open. I watched what was on the movies. And, of course, I daydreamed about that. We didn't go very often, but my mother only let me go to musicals because she was not a horror person or a sci-fi person. She only liked musicals, and she liked happy things. So it was all happy. We would go to the Esther Williams, or we would see Catherine Gleason or something like that. And it was an enchanting world. You know, it was three-stripe technicolor, although I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know what to call it, but I knew the colors were as intense as they were if you went outside in Hawaii. It was gorgeous. So I fell in love with those sets and costumes and attitudes and sounds, and I just sort of carried on from there. And when I was a little girl, I worked in the library with this with a girlfriend of mine. I was in the seventh grade, and the librarian sent me and my friend to a show on the other side of the island. My very first show, the first real show I'd ever seen, and I think it was Carousel. And we were like in the seventh grade. We had to take a bus. Oh, my God, we took a bus all the way. It must have been 20 miles, which was unheard of. And we got to the theater, and we sat down, and the curtain went up, and I remember my heart beating really fast, and the orchestra was playing, the little teeny-weeny orchestra was playing, and when the curtain went up, there were the most beautiful things, the most beautiful people I'd ever seen in my life. They were all pink, and their hair was curly, and they were wearing skimpy clothes and pink tights and high heels, and it was just like a sight that, it was a vision. It was like something, it was like a way into heaven.
A pilgrimage to Carousel is what got you.
I never got over it.
Bette Midler with us for a few more minutes here on WNYC on the occasion of the re-release of her early 80s book,
A
View from Abroad. One reason you are beloved by many New Yorkers is your work with parks and urban beautification and restoration.
Yeah.
How'd you first get into that?
Well, you know, I've always been heavily, very, very moved and very, very happy in the natural world. I love nature, in spite of what it did to me. I have a sense of order that I feel nature gives to you. I'm not saying this correctly. Let me backtrack and say I love nature and I love being in nature. And because I was brought up in probably the most beautiful spot in the whole world, the most benign spot in the whole world, we don't have any poisonous animals there, I've always felt very happy and very safe in nature. And when I came to the continental United States and I saw the carelessness with which people treated the natural environment, it really distressed me because it was a symptom of something that I couldn't really understand. That wasn't the way I had been brought up. You know, I was practically brought up in the Japanese way, which is to honor nature and that, you know, honor nature, honor your ancestors, and there's a spirit in every tree. So it made a big impression on me, and I really wanted to change it. And I know it was very, tilting at windmills to pick up a piece of garbage one piece at a time. But really, literally, that's what I set out to do. And I couldn't help myself. And I started doing it when I was very young, and it got more and more, it took hold of me in a bigger way when I came back to New York in 1995. The streets were so dirty, and the parks, some of the parks were really unlivable, uninhabitable. I mean, people literally couldn't go into them. So I started an organization called New York Restoration Project, and we started in upper northern Manhattan in Fort Tryon Park and Fort Washington Parks, and those are really, really beautiful parks, the jewels in our crown, and in fact. And we've built parks. We built the Swindler Cove on the other side of the island up by Harlem River. We built the first boathouse in 100 years on the Harlem River. We have rowing programs going out of that. And it's been a thrill. Now we're in all five boroughs. We have community gardens. We bought our community gardens just at the time when urban agriculture was taking hold of the public imagination. And that has been a real thrill to see that happen. To see people say, well, gee, we really don't have any good food here. Let's have a farmer's market or let's grow our own. It's been a thrill to watch, a thrill.
I see you've spoken up and written a letter to LG in opposition to the height of their proposed office tower that would rise above the pristine cliffs of the Palisades across the Hudson from Fort Tryon Park.
Yes.
Can you talk about that issue?
Yes, I can. The Rockefeller family deeded the Cloisters Museum and Fort Tryon Park, and bought the Palisades across from the Cloisters, so that the view would be unspoiled. It was all a package, and it was a family package, and it was given to the state of New York, and to the city of New York, and to the state of New York, and the state of New Jersey. And it was kind of an unwritten agreement. The Palisades part was an unwritten agreement, and all the towns around the Palisades have sort of held on to that code since it was given in the late 30s. And it's very, very beautiful. Now, LG, which is not an American company, it's a Korean electronics company, wants to build a gigantic tower sticking right up out of the Palisades Park, which will destroy that view and will probably encourage other corporations to do the same, so that the intent of the family will be destroyed. And I think it'll really ruin the impact of what that area had forever. And so it's distressing. It's really, really distressing. I know that change is inevitable, but certain kinds of change are not inevitable. And I think when people have what are considered national treasures or landmarks or historic landmarks or things that are really given to the entire public, not to just a conglomerate or to a corporation, they should cherish them, and they should take care. You know, they should cherish them, and they should see that generations to come are allowed to enjoy them the way we have, the way they were promised to us.
Nicely said.
I really do feel feel that it's incumbent upon us to save what belongs to future generations.
And you have at least four past New Jersey governors from both parties on your side. You know, Byrne, Florio, Kane, and Whitman have all weighed in against the LG eyesore plan. Do you have a minute for one more phone call?
Sure.
Dale in Jersey City, because I think he remembers the original release of this book. Dale? Dale, please be there. I think you have a good story for Bette Midler. Dale in Jersey City? Going once? Aw, all right.
Aww.
Well, I think he had a bookstore in Jersey City in 1980, and you did a book signing, and there was huge crowd. You remember that?
I went all over the country with my book. I sometimes say, you know, and I sold and signed every book myself. I really do believe that. Because we had these fabulous book signings where, you know, we would, put balloon. We had a little set, and we would take questions, and we would sing a little, and it was a lot of fun. People lined up, and I signed all those books. It was fun.
Wait, here he is, Dale. Where was that book signing?
That was at B. Dalton Bookseller at 666 Fifth Avenue and 53rd across from MoMA. And Miss Midler was terrific. She came in with this wonderful typewriter hat and delighted hundreds who stood in line around the block over to MoMA for hours signing the book.
There you go.
That was one of my finest hours. That typewriter hat was genius, I have to say.
You told the Daily News you never buy a book online that you can buy in a bookstore. You think we're losing something culturally important?
No question about it. I am a big, big supporter of all bookstores everywhere. I go into them. They are my public spaces of choice. I love them. I sit around for hours. I dip into, you know, hundreds of books at a time, and I love them. I mean, I have my corner bookstore up here on Madison and 94th, which I go to all the time. There's Crawford and Doyle. You know what? I'll tell you something. A town without bookstore is a town without culture. And you know what? Books themselves, print, the covers, the credits, the thank yous, the dedications, the all of it. I mean, I just love them so much. I do have my Kindle, but if I'm traveling, I'll put a book on a Kindle. But I won't just buy it to read it on a Kindle. I prefer to have the book, you know, on my belly in bed. I just prefer it.
Last question. How did you feel singing Wind Beneath My Wings at the Oscars for the In Memoriam segment? You know, you had Julia Roberts and half of America crying.
Oh.
Is it emotional for you as a performer, or do you have a different, just professional do this relationship to it?
Well, you know, that's very bright of you. If professional do this, it has to come first, because you can't crack. You know, you can't choke. It's imperative that you not choke. So you do have to keep your emotions in check. And so it's a delicate balance. I was very nervous about the first week after I had been asked, and then I had to put all that nervousness aside and really concentrate on what I had to do. So it was, you know, it was a struggle. And in the end, I said, "Oh, I feel like I just won the Olympics." I think they cut me off. I didn't see it. I feel like I just won the Olympics, because it really was like training and getting ready for the big event, and then, you know, having it go very well and having the crowd like it. It was very, very gratifying, and I was really thrilled for the opportunity.
Bette Midler's book, A View from Abroad, from the early 80s, was re-released April 1st. She's been my guest here on WNYC. This has been so much fun. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Brian. Talk to you soon.
Swears he's not to blame. Say to him, you know that broken, lonely woman. He'll tell you, no, he don't even know my name. Oh, I see
And coming up later in the show, who taught you to be a New Yorker? But up next, a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, claimed by Brooklyn, Bangalore, and Bronxville on The Brian Lehrer Show. Stay with us. He just won that prize. He'll read us some examples of why.
They tell you every woman gotta have protection. They're gonna turn around and tell you, it's your turn to fall, your turn to fall.
It's a Best of Brian Lehrer Show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we re-air some of our recent favorites for this Memorial Day. At the end of April, I spoke to Brooklyn poet Vijay Seshadri, who was awarded this year's Pulitzer Prize for Poetry for his collection Three Sections, which the judges called, quote, a compelling collection of poems that examine human consciousness from birth to dementia in a voice that is by turns witty and grave, compassionate and remorseless, unquote. That's from the Pulitzer judges. He came to this country at age 5 with his parents from Bangalore, has worked as a copy editor for The New Yorker, is now a professor at Sarah Lawrence College, and like the 2012 winner, Tracy K. Smith, lives in Brooklyn. Vijay Seshadri, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on your Pulitzer Prize. And you're being claimed now by each of those parts of your bio. Newspapers in India are pointing out that you're the first South Asian to win the prize for poetry. The New Yorker wrote a tribute. Sarah Lawrence seems excited. And the papers here describe you as a Brooklyn poet. Do you claim all those identities?
Absolutely, yeah. I would claim all the identities I can get. You know, it's like our greatest Brooklyn poet, Walt Whitman, of course, said that he contained multitudes. And, you know, if I contain 3 or 4 people, I'm sort of on my way there. That's nice.
And Brooklyn contains multitudes, which is maybe why it produces so many great poets.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we live in a really rich poetic environment there. And, you know, especially my neighborhood in South Brooklyn is crawling with poets. I mean, and
so you've agreed to give the listeners some samples of your poetry, and we asked you to read part of, or I guess all of, because this is a short one, This Morning in Three Sections, which kind of fits one picture of a Brooklyn poet. You ready?
Yeah. So I'll read This Morning first. This Morning. First, I had 3 apocalyptic visions, each more terrible than the last. The graves open and the sea rises to kill us all. Then the doorbell rang and I went downstairs and signed for 2 packages, one just an envelope, but the other long and bulky, difficult to manage, both for my neighbor, Gus. "You're never not at home," the FedEx guy said appreciatively. It's true. I don't shave or even wash. I keep the air conditioners roaring. Though it's summer, one of the beautiful red and conifer green Bayside fuel oil trucks that bed down in the depot by the canal was refreshing the subsurface tanks with black drafts wrung from the rock, blood of the rock sucked up from the crevices. The driver looked unconcerned, leaning slightly on each other. Frank and Louise stepped over his hose and walked by slowly on the way to their cardiologist.
Ha. Huh. So is that the poet's lot? Grand visions, apocalyptic imaginings, interrupted by FedEx guys and fuel oil deliveries?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. And that's sort of... It's the kind of interaction that one has when one sits down to writing in a sort of, in any environment, but particularly in a dense environment like a city like Brooklyn and a city like New York, that there are all of these noises and influences and odd inspirations and... And one of the things that I think urban poets, especially New York poets in the past 30 or 40 years, have been very good at is sort of capturing the pulse of the city, capturing its quality. And it's been a real aesthetic adventure for New York writers. And to the extent that I'm a New York writer, I tend to think that I should do that too. And that poem is an example of sort of, my living in my neighborhood, my environment, my Brooklyn environment, and sort of rendering it on the page as life was happening around me. Mm-hmm. And, some of those incidents are, I mean, the FedEx guy never told me that. And, of course.
That you're never not home.
Right. But Frank and Louise did step over the hose and walk by slowly. You know, I don't know if they were going to their cardiologist, but they're neighbors of mine who were old and had health problems. So I just...
And you could find the poetry in that simple act of them walking by your building.
Yeah.
The title of the collection is Three Sections, and it's roughly divided between, I guess, standard-length poems like the one you just read, a long prose piece on Pacific Fishes of Canada, which I haven't read. I don't know if you're channeling your inner John McPhee there or what. And a 16-page poem called Personal Essay. And you'll read for us in a minute from that. But what do the three forms offer you as a poet? Shorter poems, one really, really long poem, and a prose essay.
Yeah, I mean, I think the long poem, which I'm going to read from, sort of... is just a part of a continuing ambition I have to write a long poem. And so it was motivated as much by my literary understanding and my literary ambition. Pacific Fishes of Canada, the prose memoir, is basically about a couple of months I spent on the Bering Sea working as a biologist for the National Marine Fisheries Service in my youth.
Uh-huh.
And that was just there, I think, because I have a lot of interesting biographical material that I've never known how to put together in a book. It's sort of, and so I parked it there in preparation for putting it in a book at some point. And then the lyric poems, the short ones like the one I just read, are ones that, you know, I typically write. So, you know, and I kind of divide the book in my mind this way, that the larger material is sort of about America in a way and my experience in America, and the shorter material, the lyric poems, are things that I would write wherever I was just as a poet. I mean, they're more determined by poetry than anything else. But
So do you want to read from the 16-page poem, Personal Essay, and do you need to set up the section you're going to read at all?
Yeah, this is a little section that actually emerges in Brooklyn. What's happened in the poem up until now is that there's sort of been a real internal meditation on the part of the speaker of the poem, who seems to be sort of lost in the labyrinths of his own mind, and then he emerges and out of his own mind, and this is a little description of his emerging in the poem into the world he's actually living in. And I will read it. I'll start.
Great.
Slowly the mind finds itself in a cab. Slowly the mind finds itself in a cab on Atlantic Avenue. Suddenly it occurs to the mind that the fact that they make people live here on Atlantic Avenue reveals, as nothing else can, the criminality of this social order. Along the wound that is Atlantic Avenue from Flatbush to the sea, hacked out by a blunt axe disfiguring the earth, they pack them in by the tens of thousands. They surround them with discount tire outlets and disreputable used car dealers. Broken, unfathomable streets spreading out into Bed-Stuy and Crown Heights. Gloom under the elevated tracks of the Long Island Railroad, with which tracks a malevolent municipal authority has chosen to stitch this thoroughfare for miles and miles. Dismay in the undergirders spattered by mourning doves, lamenting in the crevices. Who here doesn't understand what they mean when they talk about the tears of things?
Wow, that's not a pretty picture you paint of Atlantic Avenue.
Yeah, I, when I go to JFK, the cab usually takes, you know, the Atlantic Avenue route, and I'm sure many of your listeners have been on that route, and it is pretty forlorn and desolate in places there. And
do you think if you lived in the countryside, you'd write about meadows and daffodils?
I probably would. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't think, you know, I mean, I think that is sort of a kind of vision of a certain kind of urban desolation, which is a part of our experience if we live in urban areas. But it's also in the poem just a moment. And it's kind of the poem sort of rises and falls in many ways. And that's probably the lowest it goes. But then it tends to kind of climb to other heights. So and that is sort of, and I do think, especially I think, you know, when I look at various neighborhoods in Brooklyn that I don't know, I say, well, what do the people do there? How do they live? You know, how do they pay their bills? And, you know, what is their life like? Because it's such an enormous borough, I mean, and there's so many people and there's so many neighborhoods. And when one has lived in a place a long time, and I've been in Brooklyn now almost 30 years, you know, you kind of, you know, the mind goes to thinking about the people around you. And
that's a good thing, better than not thinking about people around you. And we will have to leave it there for today. Congratulations to Vijay Seshadri. His collection, Three Sections, won this year's Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, and he is a professor of writing at Sarah Lawrence College. We have links to more of his work on our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. More Brian Lehrer Show coming up after the latest news. We'll continue with some funny stories about who taught New Yorkers who aren't originally from here how to be New Yorkers. But first, the latest news, live from the WNYC newsroom. It's a best of Brian Lehrer Show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter, at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer, WNYC. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. We are re-airing some of our recent favorites for this Memorial Day. And now we're going to replay a call-in we did with your stories on how you learn to be a real New Yorker. This was for transplant New Yorkers, you know, the many of you who didn't grow up here but moved to the city and made it your home. We were inspired by a sweet story from the New York Times Metropolitan Diary back in January where the homesick writer, Bill Nave, was schooled on how to eat a New York bagel the right way from a waitress at the Hotel Edison Delicatessen. When he tried to eat the bagel with his knife and fork, ha, the waitress was horrified. Here's what he wrote from that Metropolitan Diary entry back in January. Quote, "She picked up my bagel and took a tear out of it with her teeth. Looking at me as she chewed, she dropped it back on the plate and without missing a beat said, 'You're going to live here. You need to know how to eat a bagel. That's how you eat a bagel.'" Unquote. So we asked listeners, who taught you how to eat a bagel or a slice of pizza for that matter? You may remember that very early on in his mayoralty, Bill de Blasio found out how people felt when he violated the mores of the city when he tried to eat a slice with a knife and fork on Staten Island and was mercilessly mocked by the tabloids. There are these tons of little rules, and people notice when you break them. They will sometimes clue you in. We asked, who taught you how to ride the subway? Who corrected you when you first pronounced Houston Street, like the city in Texas? We collected stories on our Facebook page and our Twitter feed, and we got lots of great stories on our comments page at WNYC.org. If you're a New York transplant, even if it was 30 years ago, you can go to our comments page now and leave your story of who taught you to be a New Yorker, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Megan on Twitter said her first landlord tried to keep her security deposit, and in her fight with him to get it back, she won, by the way, he taught her how to be a New Yorker. Another person on Twitter wrote that his car was broken into 3 times in 6 years, which taught him that not even quarters should be left visible in the car as temptation. So thieves taught him how to be a New Yorker. And on the radio, we first heard from Matt in Brooklyn, who somewhat surprisingly had another how to eat a bagel story.
I have another how to eat a bagel story. Yeah, I'm actually a native New Yorker, but my husband and I moved to Brighton Beach about, I want to say, 4 years ago. And for the first, 6 to 8 months that we were there, generally I would go shopping at the fruit stands and the markets along the street, and nobody would really talk to me because they obviously knew that I wasn't Russian. So they definitely had an issue with me at first. And one day I was buying fish and stuff like that at the supermarket, and I saw that they had a bunch of cans of caviar. And I also bought some bread, and they were like, don't buy this bread. You got to buy a bagel, and you got to have it with the red caviar with butter, and that's rules of the neighborhood, and that's what I had to do. And it turned out to be such a great thing that I pretty much buy it all the time. They have cheap caviar for all the time in Brighton Beach.
That's a hoot, Matt. That's really a hoot. Bagels and cheap caviar in Brighton Beach. Allegra in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Hi, Allegra.
Hi, how's it going? Well, I have to tell you, I moved here in 2009, and I was working in the city for about 2.5 years. And when I first started going into the city every day and going around and exploring, when I would get off the subway, go to the top of the stairs, stop, look around, figure out where I am, and then move. And, I would hear people muttering behind me and be so annoyed and how rude they are. Who would say something like that? And then the first time one of my local coworkers rode the subway with me, they were mortified with me, couldn't stand to be seen with me. And now when I have out-of-town guests, I completely understand. That is an absolutely New York punishable offense because you hold up the entire flow of traffic, and I'm horrified when I think of all the people who were so annoyed with me.
Yes, don't stop at the top of the subway stairs. And yet, people stop as soon as they get into the subway doors and stand there and block the entrance day after day after day.
Well, and if you have a suitcase, you will get a mutter from me. It's going to happen.
Allegra, thanks for your call. Let's see. Liz in Manhattan didn't grow up too far away from New York, right?
No, I grew up in Westchester County, but was a true suburbanite. But before, after I moved into the city, my father took me aside and taught me how to do the proper fold, the commuter fold of the New York Times, so that when I would read the paper on the subway, it wouldn't fall onto the people on either side of me. And to this day, when I see the few other people who still read paper newspapers on the subway and they're struggling and it's falling, it's all I can do from going over to spread the knowledge.
There you go. Thank you very much. But it's true. These days you just have to load the app. Pete in Cranford, you're on WNYC. Hi, Pete.
Hi. I moved to New Jersey in 2010 from the Philadelphia area.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that different coming from Philly, but there are a few nuances I learned, particularly in the local speak. A male-to-male greeting, you would not address a female this way, but a male, you don't say hello. Of course, you say, how you doing? So that was new for me. Another thing I learned was when you are in a line of people, you are not in line, you are online, which was confusing to me. I always thought the only time you were online was when you were in the Internet. But the learning the lingo here, even 4 years in.
How you doing? Learn Pete in Cranford when he moved up to Jersey, all the way from Philadelphia. Joanne in Hastings, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I just wanted to tell you, when I came to New York in 1947, if you can believe it, that I was waiting to cross the street at Macy's, and I stood there, and the policeman in the middle of the street motioned me to come up. And he said, what's the matter? You look lost. I said, well, where I come from, you get a ticket if you cross on the red light. He said, you're in New York City now. You better cross just when everybody else does.
But what goes around comes around. Now they're ticketing for jaywalking. Thank you for your call. Kat in Irvington, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kat.
Hey, Brian. I'm a huge fan of your show. And besides listening to the Brian Lehrer Show, the rule of being a New Yorker, when I first arrived to the city and was so confused by the subway system, I used to ask people, you know, how do you know, like, where that there's a one train on 18th Street and that it's not on 17th Street? Or I used to get so perplexed by the subway system. And then I got a job as a model, and I was going around town all day to go see. And I really learned quickly about the efficiency of the subway system and how, where to enter and where to exit and how to be as efficient as possible with the choreography of the subway system, and saved myself so much time. I was not late again.
Did you become one of those people who knows exactly where the exit turnstiles are at the stop you're going to, and so you try to go into the car that lines up with
exactly.
that?
Exactly.
Kat, thank you very much. Jennifer in Times Square, also on the subways, I think. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, this is a great one. Love your show also, Brian. But I'm bending the rules a little bit. This is something that I observed. I was going rush hour after work into the subway. I work in Times Square, and there was a big group of tourists, and they couldn't get the speed right on their MetroCard. They're going too slow, too fast. And then meanwhile, you know, pedestrian traffic's building up behind me and behind the tourists. And then there's a woman behind me screams, "For God's sake, it's like swiping a violin." And I thought that was so I mean, I happen to have taken violin lessons, so I thought, oh, that's actually a really good analogy. But only in Manhattan would a New Yorker yell at you and assume that you had taken violin lessons and know her reference.
Great story. Thank you very much. Martha in Highland Park, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a native New Yorker, and I have taught people how to walk in the city. You don't look up at the tops of the buildings. If you do, you're a tourist.
There you go. But if they're tourists, then they have reason to look up.
Ah, listen, if you want to appear to be a New Yorker, don't look up. Look
right.
straight ahead.
Keep walking. Right. Once you live here for a while, you bet. Diane in New Jersey, another subway story, a horror story?
Yes, a misdemeanor. Ethics. Difference between Boston and New York. I moved from Boston in 1988, and I was on the way to a very important business meeting, suit, briefcase, and late and missing a train, so I jumped the turnstile. No big deal in Boston in the mid-'80s, early 80s, very anarchist town. And I got caught with two other guys, and we had to clean the subway station with toothbrushes, basically. But the funny part of it was telling my friends about it. They looked at me, eyes wide open, and just said, "You are a common criminal."
There you go. And this was in the 80s. This was before the Giuliani-Bratton turnstile jumping crackdown, right?
Yes.
What do you mean you had to clean it with a toothbrush? You got sentenced to hard labor in the subways?
Yes, hard labor for an afternoon, or I forget what it was, but it was not pretty.
That's a story. Amy in Brooklyn, can you do it in 15 seconds?
God, I hope so. I'm from London. I arrived and went straight into a bank and stood behind the person a little too close at the ATM machine, and the woman in front of me did lots of shaking of her head and turning around giving me evil looks and sort of... And then she finally just sort of said, "Do you mind?" And then I understood the all-important lesson of personal space in New York.
Amy in Brooklyn, originally from London, learns the all-important lesson of personal space in New York. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, thanks for all your stories of how you learned to be a New Yorker after you moved here. You can keep posting them to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Well, you've just heard three of our favorite very New York segments from the first half of 2014, if you've been listening since 10 o'clock. But if you still haven't gotten enough, we've just tweeted and posted to Facebook a link to another instant classic interview in the New York vein from when I spoke to Bob Mankoff, the cartoon editor at The New Yorker, about his book that came out back in March. It's named after a particularly hilarious cartoon caption. How about never? Is never good for you? So check out the link we just posted on Facebook and Twitter to my interview with New Yorker editor Bob Mankoff. It'll send you to WNYC.org, where the page has both the audio of the interview and photos of some of our listeners' favorite New Yorker cartoons that you've stuck to your fridges and taped to your notebooks. Enjoy the interview and post a comment with your favorite New Yorker cartoon and caption. And coming up next, we'll talk about the portrayal of people with disabilities in film. Stay with us. This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. It's New York and New Jersey Public Radio. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC. Back in March, Real Abilities, the largest film festival dedicated to disability issues and disabled filmmakers, came to town. The festival had films about everything from commuting in a wheelchair in New York City to how pharmaceutical companies set prices for bipolar medication. We welcome the festival director, Isaac Zablocki, the founder of Real Abilities, Anita Altman, and one of the filmmakers, Jake McAfee. Jake had a short film in the festival called The Commute, which you can see on our website in its entirety. Go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And in my first question, I asked Anita to give us an idea of the scope of the festival and the kinds of issues that are addressed.
First of all, I'd like to say that from the beginning, this festival was founded with a social mission, and that was really to help transform societal issues about who people are with disabilities and to really bring the face of the other, who too often is absent from our daily interactions. And it really came out of, I work at UJA Federation in New York, and we have a huge network of agencies that have been deeply involved in the service delivery system, building all kinds of programs, and realizing that that was simply not enough. It was great, but we had to take on a larger mission, and that was to bring social change. And the medium of film is pretty powerful, and I was incredibly fortunate to meet one hot summer evening a young man named Isaac Zablocki, who's sitting next to me, who's the head of the film department at the JCC in Manhattan. Told him of my dream of creating a film festival on disabilities, and he said it was about the most important thing he could do.
And before we meet Isaac, the festival director, we'll also hear from one of your filmmakers, too, who put together a beautiful piece about commuting in New York City. I do want to invite listeners into this by posting on our website. If we have people right now with disabilities of any kind, let us know how you see yourself portrayed on film or on television. Are there movies that you want to praise or critique, or how about TV shows? Go to WNYC.org and join the conversation there. We will talk briefly about Breaking Bad in a minute, but are there common mistakes that films and TV shows make, in your opinion? Maybe you saw some of the films that were in the Real Abilities Film Festival, for that matter, and you want to comment on one of those movies. You be the film critic. You be the TV critic when it comes to the portrayal of people with disabilities on what you didn't like or what you did like. Post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Isaac, one film I know you want to talk about is called Stand Clear of the Closing Doors, which was made right here in New York. Want to tell us about it?
Right. That's one of our most timely films, and it's on the topic. We deal with topics on regarding disabilities across the spectrum of disabilities, and this one's on the topic of autism specifically, and deals with a child who gets lost on the MTA, on the subways, and his family has no idea where he is and goes into a situation that's very much similar to what we recently saw covered in the news.
With Avante Okendo.
Right.
Exactly.
And I'm sure you know, listeners were captivated by that, I know, for weeks and weeks on the A train that I tend to ride into work right. in the mornings. The conductor just kept making the announcement about Avante and what he was last seen wearing and the whole thing.
It was pretty eerie because of this young boy lived – the film takes place in Rockaway Beach, and he is shown – and he's a Latino boy who walks out of school one day and then finds him, makes his way to the subway. And that's the heart of the film is his experience on the subway. And I won't tell the ending.
And
it was quite eerie. You know, we screened it and we're selecting it 3 weeks before Avante disappeared.
Wow. And watching the trailer of this film, it takes us inside the household of this child and his relationship with his sister, who doesn't have a disability. And the mother is an immigrant who only speaks Spanish, so it's really a nuanced portrayal. Right. Would you say it includes a policy critique of the, you know, way the MTA handles this kind of thing, or anything else?
I don't think it's – I think more the policy critique. First of all, his family is illegal. And I think that brings up some very strong policy critiques, and that's more on the federal level. And I think the film itself also is not specifically about the disability, and these are the kinds of films we like the most, where it's not about – he just happens to have a disability. It's with a kid with a disability, and actually the drama comes out from other places, not from specifically his disability.
There's a documentary called Here One Day.
Ah, yes.
About a woman who discovers a box of audio tapes recorded by her mother that chronicle her struggles with bipolar disorder and depression. Here is a clip from the film where we hear the daughter and some audio from the tapes.
I don't know whether I'll become manic this morning.
She was a funky mother, and I love that about her.
She was successful and powerful. She was a mockingbird.
Oh, dear. This is a bad moment.
So one thing that struck me about that film and even just reading about that film is it took this woman 16 years to actually muster the courage to listen to the tapes.
Right. And, you know, it's and it's very personal. For those of us who live on the Upper West Side, the woman, her mother is Nina Leichter, and her husband Franz Leichter was our state senator for many years. And it's a very painful and very moving and powerful film to watch, but also to powerful and important to see how the family has dealt with it and the struggles. And really, and in some ways, Kathy Leichter, the filmmaker, has used this film and the making of the film to come to terms with what has been a very arduous journey for her.
So one of the themes throughout, maybe as reflected through that story, is that we just don't talk openly about disability in a productive way. Is that one of the goals of the festival?
The festival specifically chooses films, I think, that you normally would not see. And it's not your classical portrayals of disabilities that you might see in a big Hollywood film. It's actually the stories and the real lives of these people that we are trying to bring out there. And the films, of course, are dramatic and equally exciting to any Hollywood picture, but possibly because of their subject matter are pushed a little bit to the sidelines.
You know, the other thing I'd like to point out is that the reason why we're in 32 locations is because this was really about building community conversations about people with disabilities, again, showing the face of the other. And it was about bringing these films into community. And in addition to the screening of these films, we have post-screening discussions at every screening, and part of the obligation of our partners who are out in the communities screening these films is that there needs to be a program that takes place following this, because it really is about creating a conversation and really elevating the presence of people with and the reality of who people are with disabilities. And what you see through these films is we share a common humanity. Irrespective of what, you know, other challenges an individual might have.
We're talking with the directors of the Real Abilities Film Festival, the largest festival dedicated to disability issues and disabled filmmakers. And we are also joined now for a few minutes by the director of one of the short films in the festival, Jake McAfee, who directed The Commute, And we actually got permission from Jake to put the full film on our website. It's short. So listeners, go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, and watch The Commute. It's really beautiful. Jake McAfee, thanks for joining us, and congratulations on such a great film.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And it's really simple. It just follows one man in a wheelchair on his way home. There's no dialogue, just a song by the band The National. And I guess you were just trying to show how difficult it is for someone doing something as everyday as just commuting from work to home?
Yeah, I just wanted simply to take the viewer along for a commute with someone who depends on a wheelchair for transportation and using, not necessarily New York City's public transportation, but public transportation in general. It just happened to be based here in New York, you know, as in regards to a location.
Where'd you get the idea for the film?
You know, it's funny. The film gods must have had this in the works, because I was actually in New Jersey on a New Jersey path, and there was an announcement that said that the elevator was out at my stop, and that was the end of the message. And I just thought to myself, if I were in a wheelchair, that would be terrible. I wasn't familiar with the stop. I wasn't familiar with the neighborhood, but that's where I was going. And they didn't give any options over the announcement. And 2 days later, Goodwill Industries of New York and New Jersey, they approached me and asked me if I would want to do a film, because they saw the Real Abilities Film Festival from the year before, and they said how moved they were by it, and they wanted to contribute. And it was literally 2 days after, and I remember being upset about that experience, even though I don't use a wheelchair, and I said I have the perfect story. And that's how the commute came about.
Now, it's funny that you said this could happen on public transportation anywhere, because at the end of the film, we see that you flash a title card that says there are 468 subway stations in New York City. Only 69 have wheelchair accessibility. So are you making more of a global point or more of a point about the New York City subway system?
Well, that's like a two-point thing. I think you can apply it to any city, and especially people who depend on wheelchairs, depend on public transportation and they use a wheelchair. I think anyone can relate to this story. I just thought it was amazing that New York City, out of all these train stops, that only that number are wheelchair accessible. And then you have to question how many of those accessible stops are actually functioning. So I think the number drops even lower when you put that into consideration.
Like with the casual announcement that the elevator was out.
Right.
At that particular station. You know, I want to bring a caller into this who I think has a disabled student who also made a video about the subway. So Rob in Mamaroneck, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how are you? Just a correction. It wasn't me who made the video. I was teaching a class at Fordham University with a bunch of graduate students, and one of the young women happened to be an intern at the MTA, and the other woman was confined to a wheelchair, and she was probably early 20s, had spina bifida. And when I forgot what the conversation was about, but it was about public transportation. I said, has there anyone in this class never actually been on a New York subway? And the young woman in the wheelchair, who had lived a very, very protected life, raised her hand, and she kind of motioned to her wheelchair. And so, to make a long story short, the woman from the MTA and this young woman did a video of the challenges that they had. They both happened to live in Long Island, so she met him in Long Island, took the Long Island Railroad to Penn Station, and their destination was an art gallery in Greenwich Village. And it was a very moving video that they produced, and it may still be on YouTube. I was looking for the link, but it really underscored the challenges. In many cases, they had to go to the next subway stop, as your listener just mentioned, because there wasn't an elevator, and it was scary for the girl in the wheelchair because she had never done it before. But subway commuters were very supportive. But the other thing I wanted to mention is I just got back from India, and one of my favorite photos that I took was on the Delhi subway, and next to the door, just like New York subways, where they have a sign that says, please give up your seat to a senior citizen or disabled, their sign, which is both in Hindi and in English, says, for seniors and differently abled. And I'd love to see that differently abled enter our lexicon, because as many of us know, a person who has a disability, whether they're blind or deaf or in a wheelchair, they find a way to compensate in other ways.
Jake, anything?
Differently abled is just such a positive phrase.
Jake, anything you want to say to Rob after hearing the description of his student's other film about somebody in a wheelchair and New York City transportation?
Well, no, I just think it's ironic that even while we were in the midst of filming the commute, we found ourselves stuck on a train with our lead actor, George Gallego, who's bound to a wheelchair. And it was just extremely frustrating what we had to go through. And, you know, we planned out our production day, and one night it all fell apart just because of the simple fact that we had to go so far out of our way to get to where we had to go on the train system. And, it reassured me that we were doing the right thing in regards to creating this piece.
Rob, thank you so much for calling and telling that story. And Jake McAfee, thank you for joining us for a few minutes. He's the director of The Commute, one of the films featured in the Real Abilities Film Festival. We also have the full short film of The Commute up on our webpage with Jake's permission. It's really beautiful. Go take a look at it at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Jake, thank you so much.
No, thank you.
And we still have the festival director, Isaac Zablocki, and the founder of Real Abilities, Anita Altman. And several of the films are set in New York City, and not surprisingly, many do have to do with transportation struggles. But there's also the fact that dense environments can also lead to easier access to services and less isolation in general, and more people who share your experience. So in general, do you think New York City is a positive or a negative force for someone with a disability to be?
So I was about to say, actually, on this topic of the MTA, I was going to give a positive look at it all. And with all of the criticisms, which are very much fair, and we have a long way to go, I like to think sometimes about how far we've come. Right. In the film The Commute, you see for a moment that he's on a MTA bus that has access. And that's actually an amazing thing. We don't take the moment to appreciate that all of the New York City buses today have, through technology, which is a blessed thing in this field, have access for people with disabilities, which was not ever the case in the past.
Those steps or platforms lean down to accept a wheelchair.
Right. And the other piece of it, of course, is that it has liberated people who use wheelchairs and walkers to be able to get around, and also for the rest of us who at the moment, are not in such a position, it brings us into a physical contact that we really have not had previously. I mean, it's really been amazing to watch the transformation since, I think, 1994 till now of the difference on the buses. As In the old days, it was, really intolerance about the time, and now it's taken as a matter of course.
Let's hear what some of our other listeners have to say about portrayals of people with disabilities in movies, on television. Robert in Maspeth, you're on WNYC. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have, as you surely figured out, a speech in a pediment in my. A former field, when I was a cook, all of the job in her views zoomed in on my a speech as opposed to my cooking skills, which was a hard a thing to fight through. But the times have now changed, and it is much more for giving a world, and I think that films and TV shows are now behind the curve.
Robert, I want to say that, first of all, I really appreciate your courage and fortitude in calling up and doing this on the radio. Awesome.
Well, thank you.
Is there any particular TV show or movie that you would want to critique?
I'm sort of blanking out, but I mean, I've been compared to Mel Tillis, the singer, on and on. I've been compared to Porky the pig, but somehow I fought through it all, and I carved out a good life, which some of the films or shows fail to show.
Robert, thank you so much for calling up.
Thank you, Brian.
Superb. Narae in Fort Lee, you're on WNYC. Hello, Narae.
Hi, Brian.
Hello.
So I wanted to call in and critique TV shows such as Grey's Anatomy and House, where they focus so much on characters with disabilities and how terrible their lives become from the loss of a limb or from the loss of use of a limb. My mother became bedbound when I was about 10 years old, and it was definitely hard in the beginning, but we got through it, and our lives are normal, and she's one of the happiest people that you could meet. And I see how these TV shows affect our culture, and sometimes, you know, when I'm with friends, they'll very casually say, like, oh, man, like, if I ever became disabled, like, just kill me. I'd rather die than lose my leg or something like that. And it's hard for me to hear things like that and not feel like, are you saying that her life has no value to you? Like, you would rather be dead than be in her position.
I hate to say it, but look at Million Dollar Baby, Academy Award winner. It has a fabulous film on many levels, but of course, makes that controversial message there, not to ruin the ending for anyone.
Narae, thank you. We're speaking with Isaac Zablocki, the director of Real Abilities, a film festival dedicated to disability issues and disabled filmmakers, and the founder of the festival, Anita Altman. Do you want to talk about the documentary then, Cinemability, Isaac, part of the festival, about how people with disabilities are portrayed in Hollywood?
Cinemability is exactly on this topic, and the film actually shows that Hollywood at times has wonderful portrayals of people with disabilities, but also at times, I would say, has a more patronizing approach. A person with disabilities is either a victim or a hero with superpowers or an evil mastermind, and really the day-to-day life of people with disabilities is not often portrayed in Hollywood stories.
I know Gary Sinise is interviewed in Cinemability. He played a wheelchair-bound Vietnam vet and born on the 4th of July. And there's a whole range of portrayals And I'm sorry, he was in that was Forrest Gump, right? That come to mind, such as Leonardo DiCaprio and Sean Penn playing characters who have autism. And then there's a show like Breaking Bad where the son has cerebral palsy and is played by an actor who actually does have cerebral mm-hmm. palsy. And, you know, beyond that, I think in Breaking Bad, the character's disability isn't the only thing that defines him. There are actually right. very few storylines that center around his disability. So how do you find a balance between focusing on someone's disability and trying to send a message and just having the character be a real person, which maybe sends a message of its own?
Mm-hmm. People with disabilities are completely underrepresented in Hollywood. And unfortunately, our society, of course, kind of mimics everything that Hollywood shows us and thinks that that's what the world should look like. And in truth is, people with disabilities can live a very normal life. And that is often not portrayed on TV and in mainstream movies. And I think including actors with disabilities is a great way to start changing the picture of things. And Breaking Bad did that. And you actually can really feel the normality of it. And believe it or not, actors will impact writers and the way shows are being presented.
Karen in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Karen.
Hi, good morning. Awesome show.
Thank you.
It's so powerful. I have a 14-year-old boy who has muscular dystrophy, and if I get emotional, this is so important, what you guys are doing.
It's all right. We can stay with you.
First of all, I have to say, one of my favorite shows my son watches now is Family Guy. You have somebody in a wheelchair having fun, living life, married. He connects with him, and he laughs, and it's not all about the sadness and the stress and the anger of being somebody who's different. I had called first when you were talking about the bus system. We use the bus system every day in New York City since he was diagnosed at 6 to get to school. Mm-hmm. I refuse to put him on a private bus. He needs to know how to get out in the world and use the world in which he lives in. And I think the biggest problem we had at the beginning, it's very simple, was just the ramps on the bus. When they were in the back of the bus, mm-hmm. the time it took to get on a bus made everybody so angry because everybody's in a rush. When they went to the front bus ramps, the energy of the bus changed. People are more acceptable. As for the MTA workers, I really believe there should be some educational experience for all people who are dealing with the public about people that are different from you. We've had it in the past dealing with race and with LGBT and the gay rights. And I think now it's not time that the MTA needs to put that on the platter. And these bus drivers, they don't know how to act. Some are awesome, and then some just don't know what they're doing. And it can be very frustrating.
Karen, but thank you so much. And one more. Richard in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my call. I'm a polio survivor. I had polio when I was 6, and now I'm 70. And I've lived a very, very normal life. I got married. I have a son. I was a teacher for 37 years and did a lot of things. And I would like to see more movies and TV programs where handicapped people are just portrayed as people and not as heroic for what they're doing, because I never wanted to be a hero. All I ever wanted to do was to participate in life, you know, and to do, you know, and I tried a lot of things just like everybody else tries a lot of things. And in many things I was successful and some I couldn't do. But the main thing is that I would just like to see, just like in Breaking Bad, that kid is they don't make anything of that. He's a functioning kid. You see that he has difficulties, but he's in all other respects a normal teenager. And I would just like to see handicapped people or people with various disabilities being portrayed sort of like they could be walk-ons, mm-hmm. but they're just to be part of the whole scene and to just be portrayed in a normal way.
I have to tell you, Anita Altman is practically elevating out of her seat. She's so enthusiastic to back you up here.
Right. And, you know, we screened an amazing film last year called Doc Pomus, which you ought to get on Netflix or, you know, I'm hoping that as our festival, this is our sixth annual festival, and you know, one of the things I want to mention also is that we inspired and now have a National Real Abilities Film Festival, which is taking place in 14 metropolitan areas across the country, with San Francisco Bay Area coming on most recently with their opening in October. But what was I going to say?
About being portrayed as ordinary?
Yeah, you know, that is the intent of it's really about, you know, sharing our common humanity. And, you know, that is at the heart of it.
And we also have on our page now, coming in during our conversation, links that people are starting to post to other films, their favorite portrayals
Fantastic.
Of people with disabilities and things like that. So you can see all of that stuff. Folks at WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. You can also watch Jake McAfee's short film that we discussed before, The Commute. So go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show for all the information. And festival director Isaac Zablocki and founder of Real Abilities, Anita Altman, thank you so much for taking time out from Red Carpet Day for what I think was a very powerful moment. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up next. Eberhard van der Laan, the mayor of Amsterdam. It's the best of Brian Lehrer Show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter, at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer, WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Okay, I'm thinking of a city. It's a diverse city with a reputation for tolerance, containing people of 180 nationalities. It's an international business and cultural capital, and it's a low-lying city located by the water and is sometimes prone to flooding. If you just tuned in, you may think I'm talking about New York. If you heard me promote this section, you know it's Amsterdam. And as it happens, the mayor of Old Amsterdam is visiting New Amsterdam today, and we are happy to welcome to our studios Mayor Eberhard van der Laan. Let's compare notes. Mayor van der Laan, welcome. Is it your first time in New York?
No, I've been several times in New York.
But how would you begin to compare New York and Amsterdam on anything? Just as a random question.
The way like you did it. It was a nice introduction. Well, New York is 10 times bigger, and I'm fully aware of that. But there are a lot of similarities, yes, indeed.
I heard a rumor that you're actually here to steal our jobs, to tell everyone what a great city Amsterdam is for doing business. Is that why you're here?
I'm here to tell what a great city Amsterdam is for business, but, you know, trade has as an essence that it's vice versa. So when we cooperate and be partners, like we are already, of course, there will be more jobs for everyone.
Well, you can't have our jobs, but I'm curious how you're making your case, because there's a big disgruntlement right now in New York's business community that our progressive new mayor, Bill de Blasio, is raising workers' issues like paid sick leave and living wages and talking about raising taxes on people making $500,000 a year or more, which is often business owners, all things that Mayor de Blasio has been talking about. Do you want to compete with New York on those issues and say, look, we've got a better business climate?
No, absolutely not. In fact, a bit the contrary. The things you mentioned he wants, I think we mainly already have in the Netherlands as a social state. So that's no competition, no.
So how would you compare minimum wages and paid sick and vacation time guarantees in Amsterdam with New York? What do they get paid in fast food restaurants there? What do they get paid in car washes? Can you convert it to dollars or anything relative?
Well, I think the minimum is in the Netherlands around 1,300 euros. So let's say $1,500.
That's per what?
That's per month.
Oh, $1,500 per month. So less than $400 per week. And so it's I would have to do a little more number crunching to figure out just how close it is. But it might actually be a little more. That might be closer to – yeah, that's closer to $20,000 a year if it's $400 a week. And that would be significantly higher than a minimum wage worker earns here.
Yeah, well, that would not surprise me because, of course, we have the Rhineland history. In Europe, we compare the Anglo-Saxon working conditions and traditions a bit lower. We estimate them lower than we have in Europe because we think that here it is, well, more capitalistic.
And so do you have higher unemployment? Because the free market marketeers would say if you have, you know, higher wages, then the employers are going to create fewer jobs. Do you have higher unemployment in Amsterdam?
I think we have. In Amsterdam, we have in general a 10% unemployment now. Of course, there is a bit of a crisis still in Europe. But what worries us especially is unemployment amongst youth. That's 20%.
Among youth, that's high.
That's high.
We have that here too.
No, but we think it's very high. And in some neighborhoods, of course, also Amsterdam has a bit of a segregation in times of crisis especially. It comes up to 40 or 50%. So that really worries us.
What's the nature of segregation there? New York has been described in a recent study as having the most segregated schools in America. What's the nature of segregation in Amsterdam?
About this, you will hear a very chauvinistic mayor, because I think it's a tradition in Amsterdam that we're a city of merchants, and for centuries they were allowed to strive their own well-being, but always people expected that they would also look behind to those who stayed behind and take them with them. So differences are not so big in our city, and we cherish that very much. Have to fight for it every day because it's, of course, the market and nature does not create an equal city by itself. But we can shape it a bit.
How diverse is Amsterdam at this point?
Very much. You mentioned, I think, the 180 nationalities. And we're rather proud of that. It has always been the case in Amsterdam for many centuries that about half of the population is Amsterdam-born and the other has chosen to be there. So there's a little competition between the two, who is the best Amsterdamer.
How much at this point of African descent or Arab descent, South Asian descent?
We have 10% people from Morocco, some 8% origins from Turkey, and I think it's about 15% from Suriname Antilles, that's Spain.
And both cities have their intergroup tensions. I've heard it said that Amsterdam is so tolerant that it's too intolerant of intolerance. And that usually comes out in the way that says some of your people are tougher on your Muslim residents, assuming they're intolerant toward gay rights, for example, as some would be, depending on the nature of their observance. How much of a problem would you say that is in your city right now? Or how much of a tension between tolerance and intolerance of intolerance?
This is going to be complicated, but I think you're right. There is a lot of tolerance. That is partly the history of the city. Being merchants, they had to be tolerant to be successful. Yes, indeed, some of the immigrants has brought along religions and cultural habits that were not exactly in favor of transgenders and homosexuality. So we also have had that tension, but I think on the whole, the people of Amsterdam say, no, you don't touch our tolerance. And the difficult thing, may I add, is that, of course, when it comes to liberty, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and all those freedoms, a very important freedom is a freedom from fear, and so safety is connected to it too.
Do you see that as different in the United States, or do you think we're having the same exact conversation?
I think you have the same conversation here, and in times, I think one is ahead, and in other times, the other can be ahead. But New York, like San Francisco, where I came from in beginning this week, and Amsterdam, they're quite alike.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We are comparing notes with the mayor of Amsterdam, Mayor Eberhard van der Laan. If you have a comment, you can join the conversation at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And to some degree, our cities have reputations for tolerance in different ways. If people have just a casual, stereotypical notion of Amsterdam, they may think, oh, they have legal prostitution. They have legal euthanasia. They have legal hashish coffee shops. We don't have those things. So is there something about those, that nexus that defines tolerance Amsterdam style or Netherlands style?
This tolerance is, as I said, originates from early days of Amsterdam when the merchants had to be tolerant because immigrants in those days created added value to the city.
And very similar to New York in that respect, yeah. And I think coastal cities all over the world.
Yeah, but I think I might be a little chauvinistic about the fact that it was rather early in Amsterdam in the 17th century, and it was substantial. Did you know that Amsterdam was then 70% of world trade was Amsterdam-based? So what New York was in the 20th century, London in the 19th, Paris in the 18th, really Amsterdam was in the 17th century. And the tolerance has become an institution. For we have churches. Of course, there was a governing religion that was Protestantism, but the Catholics, they were always allowed to have churches in the backyards. So that's, of course, it's a bit opportunistic, I must admit, but it has always been a basis of the city.
So Glenn in Richmond Hill, you're on WMRC with the mayor of Amsterdam.
Thanks for letting me ask the mayor a question about Amsterdam's bicycle transportation system. How does Amsterdam promote and foster a bicycle culture when New York City's recently instituted bicycle system is already in financial difficulty?
Well, thank you for the question. I must say we have a bit of luck because we are a flat country, so cycling, we already do that for a century. And indeed, it is very nice in terms of sustainability. Amsterdam is also small. So that could seem a disadvantage, but in fact it is an advantage of being small. And 50% of the Amsterdamers do cycle every day. And it's interesting to say that our problem is not to get the Amsterdamers on the bike, but we have a huge problem in parking bikes and make them. And another problem is they consider themselves a bit the rulers of town, so they should have a better behavior towards those who walk on the streets.
I have to say that the one time that I was in Amsterdam, it was in January. It was freezing cold. There was snow and ice on the ground. And I was amazed that people were biking. I don't know if they had snow tires or chains or what. And they were tying them up everywhere on every railing. I took some photos because I was so struck by the sort of ubiquitous bicycle landscape of Amsterdam, and that people kept going and people tied them up outside in the snow. So it's certainly a hardy city when it comes to bicycle culture. The caller was specifically interested, I think, in a bike share program, which is having some financial difficulties in New York. Do you have something like that in Amsterdam?
No, but we don't need to because the average Dutchman has 1.7 bikes. So why should we share 1.7 bikes per individual?
What do they do? Do they keep a road bike and a mountain bike?
Or? Usually for in town, also because of fear for theft. Quite a few bikes are stolen. They have an old, ugly bike for daily use. But when they want to do a tour or something, they take the other bike.
The security experts say in New York the best advice is keep a crappy bike, but a great lock. Jennifer in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jennifer.
Yeah, hi. I just want to say I just got back from Amsterdam. Fantastic city, but I was actually going to make a similar point, is that a lot of the comparisons are so difficult to make because your city's so small, and you just said that, actually. And ours is at least, I think, 10 times bigger. I don't know how much bigger in landmass, but definitely population. So I think we have to – how do you think we can kind of – what things can we best transfer from the fabulousness of Amsterdam to New York City and its crazy largeness?
Having just visited it, Jennifer, with fresh eyes, what would you want to? Anything on first impression?
Well, it's more the people and how relaxed they are and calm. I think that's a lot of the bike culture there. You know, it's just much, it's just much freer.
Uh-huh. And people are
feeling.
More relaxed. You think it's a chill city, Amsterdam?
Yeah, not always. But I think Jennifer is right. New York is 10 times as bigger, more or less, and it creates more traffic, more tension. So that is not an asset of Amsterdam, or a merit of Amsterdam, I should say. But it is Amsterdam is not only a place where you can be born or where you come to live. It has become also a kind of mentality, and people they really get Amsterdamers, and they can live in New York as well.
Ryan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with the mayor of Amsterdam. Hi.
Yes, hi. How's it going?
Okay.
My question was that although, yes, New York is the great melting pot, we still do have a lot of segregation in the city, and there are many different cultures, but they often tend to stay to themselves. I was wondering if there was anything that you guys do in Amsterdam to combat segregation.
That's a good question, and the answer would be too long if I tell you all the things we try to do, because we're not always successful. But it has been for more than a century that there is a housing policy, especially, in which we try to get representative neighborhoods where everyone can live. And we had one terrible lucky thing. Already in the 19th century, workers' communities started housing corporations. And a large part of the houses in Amsterdam are owned by these housing corporations, and they give us an instrument to make sure that we don't get very rich neighborhoods and very poor neighborhoods. So that's a bit of luck, too, that we owe to our ancestors.
Oh, Nanette in Ridgewood, New Jersey, is going to be a troublemaker because she's still thinking about our last segment on legal rights for animals. Nanette, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Yes, hi, how are you?
Okay.
When I was there in the late 60s, I went into a very small Amsterdam restaurant, and there was a dog in the restaurant, and they told me at 8:30 at night, there's no food for you, but, you know, the dog is licking its chops. So, I mean, is that still permitted, and how do they prevent, you know, proximity of other dogs, and does that still go on?
We were just having, I know you weren't here yet, we were just having a conversation before you came up. About how much pets, dogs in particular, should be allowed into restaurants and stores and other public places.
I heard one sentence, and I laughed at the term bureaucrats. Well, the lady comes from dangerous territory because I used to have a dog, so I'm in favor of dogs, and I think we have no regulations in Amsterdam that dogs couldn't be in restaurants, but of course, there are all kinds of rules on sanitary and health. So the behavior should be appropriate.
It depends on the restaurant.
It depends also on the restaurant.
They can bar dogs.
But there's no
general rule. Doesn't happen very much.
No, you hardly see it.
All right. Well, there you go. There's more fodder for the legal rights for animals movement.
Yes.
I got an email yesterday from our mutual friend, Ben Barber, author of the book, If Mayors Ruled the World, Als Bürgermeisters würden regieren. Is that close?
Niet as close.
You say it. If mayors ruled the world in Dutch?
Als burgemeesters zouden regeren.
Thank you. Well, I was not close at all.
Well, a bit.
And his book just came out in Dutch, so he sent me that transliteration, but it didn't come to much. But he mentioned the Netherlands as a nation of cities in a Europe of cities. A fundamentally different relationship, a more supportive relationship between national governments and cities than in the United States. Would you say that's the case as Ben Barber sees it?
I think he sees it perfectly right, and I find his book very inspiring. I had the honor of talking to him a few times. But there is always a difference that should be mentioned. In the Netherlands, mayors are not elected directly by the citizens. They are chosen by the city council and then officially appointed by the government. While here, of course, you have the directly elected mayors. So I think in the United States, mayors have a lot more responsibilities and authority. And then his theory is more substantial than in the Dutch situation. But still, his analysis I share.
Don in Lambertville, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Maybe you can, you have an expert now. Maybe the, you and your people and the good mayor can clear up this story that I once heard. I would like to thank the Dutch for all their influences in this country. What most noticeable today is the architecture that we see, you know, especially in the downtown and the older areas of New York City. But getting back to the tolerance issue, I heard a story, and I, maybe the mayor can, or you guys can confirm it for me, that when Peter Stuyvesant first came and they founded New Amsterdam, that there was a boat came in and it had Jewish people on it, and Peter Stuyvesant did not want to let Jews come onto the island, but that the folks, his bosses, back in Amsterdam said to him, no way, we don't care what they are. We let everybody, we want everybody to come in. And that's how the Jewish, the early Jewish people came onto Manhattan over Peter Stuyvesant's objection.
Don, I'm going to leave it there, but your question is clear. And, of course, that's New York history, not Amsterdam history. But do you learn that when you take history in the Netherlands? Do you know if that's true?
Brian, that's New Amsterdam history, and thus, in a way, this man is right. It is also New York history. I don't know his specific story, but I know Peter Stuyvesant was, by origin, an Englishman who was hired by the Dutch VOC, the Dutch tradesmen that sent the ships all over the world. So he was working on the authority of the Dutch. And maybe, I don't know the story, but I can imagine, because Amsterdam was in those days already really a place for refugees, Jewish people from Portugal, but also Eastern Europe.
New Amsterdam was.
But no,
Amsterdam
originally
was.
Amsterdam, uh-huh. And that was then already the case for some 50 years. So I really can imagine that this man is right. But the interesting thing is about New Amsterdam and New York. I was in a conference where Mr. Bloomberg held a wonderful speech, but a bit too bold about New York. And then I made a joke in my table where the Manchester mayor was. And I said, come on, Mr. Bloomberg, we founded you. And then the mayor of Manchester said, oh, no, you didn't. You founded New Amsterdam. We founded New York. So I am a bit careful on the issue. But you could argue.
I guess so. I wish I was a fly on the wall for that conversation between you and the mayor of Manchester and Michael Bloomberg. But I think the thrust of, and I don't know the particular, but I think the thrust of Don's story is true, that it was a more tolerant place when the Dutch ruled New York than when the British did right afterwards. And then some of that had to be recaptured. We're almost out of time, but two things that need to come up when we're comparing notes between Amsterdam and New York. Rebuilding post-Sandy. Amsterdam always as a model with dikes out in the water and, you know, parts of the Netherlands and things like that. Amsterdam actually lies below sea level, right?
1.5 meters.
And someone told me your approach to managing water is not always to keep it out, but in some ways to let it in.
Yes, I think water management, as we call it, is very important, and it's really an expertise. It's, a lot of Dutch are working in it. We have a problem, though. The average inhabitant of our country is not even aware that we have all those systems and that he would be a fish if we hadn't had those systems.
Canals, really, right?
The canals is one of the early products of the water management, and we're so glad that they build them because they're also quite nice to look at.
Advice for New York? Should we have an actual canal on Canal Street or something along those lines?
No, I'm not in a position to give any advice, but I know New York is doing also a lot on water management, and we make our mistakes also in Amsterdam. Our architects built data centers below sea level. And, of course, when we have a flood, that is not a very good situation. But, yes, may I add this, Brian? I told you we were a city of merchants that were independent, not a city of kings and bishops. But the second thing is, because of this water situation, they had to cooperate. So it's a fine combination of ownership. They thought the city was theirs, but there was also the need to cooperate to keep it alive.
And everyone is always curious before you go when talking about Amsterdam about the legal cannabis cafes.
I knew you would ask the question.
Am I right that there is a backlash against those because they actually do lead to more crime in those areas?
No, but we in Amsterdam we have some 200 coffee shops, and that's we have four big cities. That's two times as much as the other three cities, Rotterdam, The Hague, and Utrecht. And what we try to do is to get more distance between schools and coffee shops. So those coffee shops too close in the neighborhood of schools, they will be closed, and we will maintain some 160, which still is, I hope you trust me, quite enough.
But maybe Washington State and Colorado here have jumped over you. Are you watching those experiments to not just limit it to coffee shops, but to just make it, well, anybody can have it anyway, so maybe you don't need those districts with their problems?
Absolutely. And I admire Colorado for this, because we still have a problem, what we call at the back door. It is legal to sell it to individuals, and they can legally buy it, but it is illegal to give storage to the shops. And that is a typical Dutch gedoog, tolerance situation. And Colorado is really state of the art in solving that problem.
Anything else you want to say to the people of New Amsterdam from the mayor of Old Amsterdam?
That I enjoyed very much being in New York, because believe me when I say all Amsterdamers that have been to New York, they love it.
Meeting with Mayor de Blasio while you're here?
No, I understood that he was in his 100th day and having a lot of effort to explain what he had done.
Just say pre-K a lot and maybe he'll let you come in. Pre-K.
Pre-K.
Yeah, I'll explain after the show.
Okay.
Eberhard van der Laan, the mayor of Amsterdam. A delight to meet you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Have a great Memorial Day. Remember to take at least some time to honor our war dead in some way. And thanks to all of you for listening. And I also want to thank the team that works behind the scenes of this program. The Brian Lehrer Show is produced by Lisa Allison, Jody Avergan, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Paige Cowett, Mary Eileen Croak, and Shumita Basu. Megan Ryan is our executive producer. Our interns for the segments you heard today were Dara Barra, Dominika Dabrowska, Johanna Mayer, Nick Trotta, and Dana Varinsky. I'm Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Back live tomorrow.